Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast with me, Joanne O'Riordan. Welcome to part two of my interview with Tracy Kennedy, where we discuss the Páirc Uí Chaoimh issues, how she rose through the ranks of administration, and how she's now the first ever female chairperson of Cork GAA. 2015, you were vice chairperson, weren't you, in Cork at that stage? Well, were you just a year in office, or?
I was. Yeah, I had been elected at the start of the end of 2014, so that was my first year.
But 2015 was a difficult year for you personally, which, again, going back to what we were saying earlier, a lot of people don't know that you've got another life as well to it. Like, and you were diagnosed, unfortunately, with cancer. You were diagnosed with cervical cancer. That's hard. And I know you always say, oh, I'm very lucky because I was diagnosed with one of the more treatable ones.
I was at the earliest stage.
Yeah. But still, like, when you hear that word, that's intense,
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, that kind of in late 2014, the thing I was dreading most about 2015 was being 40.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was dreading most, I can tell you, I was glad to see 41.
Yeah.
So I was, I had my routine smear in January, the end of January. Actually, I had delayed it maybe a month, that kind of thing. Nobody likes them. And there was Cervical Cancer Awareness Week was on there, and I said, oh, so I better go and do this, so did that. And I'd had several smears before, never had any issues, so I wasn't expecting anything.
Yeah.
And then I got a call to say that they had discovered I had precancerous cells. Now, I'd heard of people having abnormalities. That seems to be fairly routine, but this was a stage beyond abnormality.
Yeah.
It was precancerous cells. So obviously that upset me a bit. It was certainly a bit of a shock to get. But at that stage, it wasn't really anything to worry about. It just wasn't very pleasant. I had to go for a couple of further treatments. Colposcopy became a word that I'd never heard before. Not a pleasant experience for any women out there who've had one. You'll know what I'm talking about. And men, be glad you never have. And I had to go for a couple more. It's just, I suppose, a more investigative type of smear test.
Mm.
I had to go for a few of those, a couple more of those. And then they removed some cells. We're kind of moving on a bit of time now, moving on into the summer. I had cells removed, and they discovered when they removed those cells that there was actually a little bit of cancer behind them.
Yes.
So, yeah, it wasn't what I was expecting. And I suppose I was very, very lucky at the time to have the support of Dr. Khan.
Yeah.
He was somebody that I could ring up and say, listen, what does this mean? And he reassured me very early on. He said, look, I've checked and they tell me you're not going to die. So that was a big relief.
You hear the word.
And as I say, you don't expect it. That's the thing. You hear of these things happening to other people, you don't expect they'll ever happen
and
to
you. And you hear of all the statistics, one in two, one in five. But you're still won't be that one. I'll be the four that don't get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't think of it being yourself at all. But cervical cancer, at the time, 90 women a year die roughly in Ireland from cervical cancer.
Yeah.
So I know there's been a lot of controversy about, cervical check and so on. But, it saved my life possibly.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had that smear test.
Does all kind of that publicity, I'm not saying upset you, but are you getting kind of angry that women are oh, I don't want to go for a smear test now because just in case it doesn't come back. But you're at least if you go, you'll know,
Yeah, that's my biggest fear because, sure, things go wrong and things have gone wrong and it's terrible. It's appalling that women have died as a result of this or have had to have far more invasive treatments than they might have needed to have.
Yeah.
That's horrific that has happened. But there still have been a lot of women whose lives have been saved by cervical check. And it is important that women do continue to go for their smear tests. Hopefully the system will be improved. That's what we have to hope for.
Yeah.
And they're going to roll out HPV testing as well, I think, which a lot of other countries already have. And that's brilliant. And we need all those things and it needs to improve. But in the meantime, women still need to continue going for their smears. I remember the first day I went to the oncologist and he said to me, look, I'm not worried about you. You're going to be okay. You go for your regular checkups. He said, it's the women walking up and down outside there who've never had a smear test or who don't go regular. They're the ones I worry about.
Yeah.
And that is, it's frightening to think that there are women who don't regularly have this test.
Yeah.
And, it's not a pleasant test. That's the reality of it. It's not the worst thing you'll ever have in your life. You're never going to be going, yes, it's my smear test day. That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's a very small thing. It takes a few minutes and it could save your life. So if there are still women out there who haven't had one, within the 3 years or whatever, please, please, please have one.
I remember an old PA of mine, she had just turned 25 and your story had just come out. And because she read it, she felt like, not kind of shocked by it, but she was like, oh my God. And actually she went for her smear test, but she turned out fine. But even she was saying the same, that as a result of hearing you and other people kind of coming out, you know, that she's now kind of, you know, kind of going for them regularly. And as she said, it's not like you get the letter and you're like, woohoo.
You know, not a nice experience. But no, and I remember people at work now, girls at work coming up to me, you know, saying, oh, listen, I booked my smear test, you know, that kind of thing. And I feel like I'm quite happy to talk about my experience.
That's what I was going to say. Is it comfortable for you? Because it's a very... Yeah. Like private conversation, you know, it is your health.
It is my health, but I suppose I know other women who've been affected by cancer and don't find it, you know, found maybe had more, much more traumatic experience than I had, don't find it as easy to talk about it. And I feel lucky that I can talk about it. And if there's even one person listening to this who goes off and has a smear test as a result of listening to me talk or goes to their doctor about some other health concern they have, then I feel there's some positive outcome out of my experience. You know, because I had to have major surgery, I had a hysterectomy, all of that was unpleasant. And, you know, it has changed my life, and like I can't have children as a result, those kind of things. But at the same time, I'm alive.
Yeah.
You know, I'm alive. And I think of some of those other women whose stories have been coming out recently who had far worse experiences than I had. They've had to have far more intense treatments. I didn't have to have any chemotherapy or radiotherapy. I can function normally. So like I'm lucky as a result, you know, compared to lots of other women. And as I say, I'm alive.
Yeah.
You know, and so therefore I am lucky, I am privileged. And if anything I can do can just make another woman go and have her smear test, then at least there's something.
It must have been hard though, because I remember when I was when I was about 16, I have a like scoliosis, so there's a curvature of the spine. And it's not like intently like sore or anything, because everyone's like, oh, are you in pain? I'm like, no, I'm fine normally. And I remember they said to me that they could operate, but they'd restrict my movement. And I remember thinking, like, at the age of 16, like, oh, you can't take away my movement. Like, that's everything that I possibly have. But I knew at the same time that this was going to end up giving me like an extra 10 years of life. Mm. Were you kind of feeling the same when you were faced with that choice? Were you like, Alison, look, there's plenty of other ways I can go about this if I wanted to. You were saying earlier, you know, your nephew was born in Dubai and things like that. So you have other means, I suppose, nowadays. Like, it's not much of a taboo anymore, I suppose.
Yeah, it's different. And I suppose I was again lucky enough, I was at a stage in my life, maybe I'd say I was 40, where I probably figured I wasn't going to go having six children anyway, you know, at that stage. So it wasn't maybe as difficult a decision for me as it might have been for somebody else who desperately wanted to have children.
Yeah.
And again, that makes me quite lucky. And I'm lucky to have other wonderful children in my life. As I say, my first nephew has just been born, little Hugo, and he's just adorable. And I also have, my friends have very generously allowed me to share their children. I have a beautiful goddaughter as well, Orla, and lots of other our friends' kids and so on. So I've got to make sure there's somebody to bring me chocolate in the nursing home, you know, when I'm in my old age. But yeah, it was it. And I remember a good friend of mine actually saying to me, you know, there's no point having kids if you're pushing daisies.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, that was the thing. I mean, when it becomes, and it's like you as well, when the choice is, okay, I get to live a bit longer, it's not maybe that difficult to choose.
Yeah, and you take it and you know, like, you'll have your cats.
Exactly. Worst case
scenario. Okay, you'll have your cats.
I've been warned by a friend that I shouldn't have more than one cat, because if I get a second cat, I'm in danger of becoming crazy cat lady.
Yeah, so you'd be one in Simpsons. You'd be at like Barky Queeves throwing cats at everyone.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to go down that route, so we limit it to one cat.
Yeah. I suppose 2017, you became chairwoman, and that was obviously a major step for you. I remember someone basically said that you got flowers from Liz Howard, who 4 decades ago was actually the first woman to sit on a board as PRO in Tipperary. Obviously, that's like really lovely and everything like that. Were you, obviously you were happy, your family and everything else. Like, how did you feel when it was like read out like, oh, Tracy Kennedy's elected?
Yeah, it was a bit unreal. I'd always had elections. So I had an election for PRO, I had an election for vice chair, but I was unopposed for chair. Mm. So in some ways it was a little bit of an anticlimax in that, you know, it was brilliant, don't get me wrong. I didn't have to fight an election. That was super. And so it was kind of like once the dates for nominations had closed and there was no one opposing me, it was like, oh, right, okay, I'm going to be the next chair of the county board. So yeah, it's a little bit unreal.
Yeah.
I don't think I had never set out with an ambition to be chairperson. It was just that I enjoyed my involvement so much. And there's only, you know, you can only go up in our current structures. We're looking at that at the moment, that you could move around at different levels, you know, without having to go necessarily up the ladder. But at this current time, there was no option for me. If I wanted to stay involved at county board level, it had to go up the ladder. So yeah, a bit of an anticlimax. My family, I think they think I'm demented, you know. No, they're very, my family are supportive. My mother is brilliant. My dad is dead. He died in 2010. My mother is very, very supportive of anything I do, Do you know?
Is it like my mother going, I haven't seen you in about 12 Sundays. Are you going to come?
Yeah, they're good at the guilt. But no, my mother's brilliant. And they just think, if I said to my mother, you know, I think I'm going to, I don't know, climb the Himalayas and I might do it in a bikini, you know, she'd probably say, oh, grand, Tress, yeah, that's great.
Whatever. Off you go.
Yeah, no bother. You know, they're very supportive. My sister, I think.
My mother's the person that would go, will I drive you?
Yeah, exactly. So they would support whatever I did, even if they think I'm a bit demented. So they were delighted. It was lovely. My mum was able to come to the convention where I was installed.
Oh, lovely.
It was lovely for her. Yeah. You know, it was really nice for her. So it was, a very sort of surreal.
Yeah. But it was coming as well at a time, I suppose, where there seemed to be a women in sport kind of, I'm not saying movement because it sounds very dramatic, but there was a lot of stuff happening to promote like female participation in sport. And I think a lot of times where people forget is to focus on administration as well, which 20 by 20 are doing at the moment. And that's something as well that you're obviously passionate about. Like, do you think it's important that we get all these various voices at board levels just to kind of show, you know, because I mean, people always say to me, oh, it's obviously because Tracy Kennedy's involved. That's why the ladies football are playing double headers. And I'm like, alas, Tracy, you know, so is it because of you?
Well, I'm not going to take all the credit for it. I think, like you say, there has been a huge movement. I find it a really noticeable movement in the last few years. There's much greater visibility. I think it's a change in society. It's not just about sport, you know. There's much greater visibility of women in sport at all levels, whether it's playing or administration. And that's really important. When you think how long ago it was that Liz Howard was the first female county board officer and how few there have been since.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only the second ever female county chairperson in Ireland now, so the clubs abroad or the counties abroad do have more women involved in them at some times. But I think there's a much greater movement, so it makes it easier maybe to be a woman involved in sports administration at this current time.
Yeah.
But, you know, we still need massive improvements. Do you know, and what worries me, I suppose, about Cartier is I don't see the next woman.
Yeah.
I don't see the conveyor belt, even though there's absolutely amazing women involved in clubs. Such fantastic women. And they're in all officer roles in clubs. I think we probably have more female club chairpersons at the moment than we've ever had.
Cool.
Which is great. It's improving all the time. There are a number of clubs who have all female senior officer boards. So we'll say their chairperson, secretary and treasurer are all women. Mm. That's brilliant. And it's great to have that mixture, because you must have balance, Joanne, you know, in anything.
Yeah.
You need different voices. Now, it's not just about women. I'm also a bit disturbed about the general lack of diversity.
Yeah.
You know, in the GAA particularly. Mm. I mean, when I look around the room I'm in, it's still very much a white male environment.
Mm.
And there are very few people with different abilities involved. There are very few people from diverse cultural backgrounds involved. So, like, there's a whole, I'm not going to try and solve all that now, you know.
Still, I mean,
but there is a whole change needed in that area. We need generally more diversity.
I think even every sport kind of struggles with that. Like, I mean, I think back in January, Karen Brady came in from West Ham. So she's the chairperson of West Ham Football Club. And even she was saying that, like, fair enough, she's promoting women in sport. But she was like, there's also, like, you know, race in sport, ability in sport. Like, there's so many other areas that we still have to cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be a big challenge.
Yeah.
Because again, I think, and this is good, like, these are things we need. There is generally an awareness that we need, like, you're doing a brilliant job. Like, I mean, the leadership role you're playing, you know, for people with disabilities and the role that you're involved in and what you're doing here in terms of media and so on, you're making that very visible. I follow Sinead Burke as well. And like, you know, she's brilliant as well for raising awareness.
If you ever want to feel like a culture, stand next to Sinead Burke.
Really?
Like, yeah, she's always dressed in like Armani.
Oh, I know. I just love looking at her Instagram. But like the work she's doing again for raising awareness.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, she just has put some small things even on Instagram at times that just makes me think, God, I never thought of that. Even just image descriptions.
Yeah.
Do you know? And we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
You know, we really have.
There's even things that you or even I would take for granted. Mm. Like, I'd be often on boards and I'd have to speak on behalf of all disabilities. And I'm like, I'm not blind. I'm not deaf. I don't know how this is going to work. Like, I remember 2 years ago I was in England and Man City were opening a new autism unit. And someone messaged me saying, you should go down and visit. And I was like, why? Like, you know, and I understand what they meant, but like, I was hardly going to go to an autism unit, you know, just to, you know, show face, you know, things like that.
But you become a representative the same way as I'm sort of expected to represent all women, even though like women in sport have hugely different experiences and that it's there. And there is definitely, like, you know, it's interesting that you said about the fact that I'm involved. Is that the reason why the ladies are, you know, are playing the double headers? But if that wasn't happening, like, there's greater pressure on me to make sure that happens.
Did you find that you was, know, like, on your, I must do this because people are driving me demented about it?
Well, it's not even that, but there's an expectation that I will do things to promote women's sport, which is fine. I have no problem with that. But that pressure wasn't on all of the chairpersons who went before me because they were men. So they were only, it wasn't expected of them. And I suppose sometimes that frustrates me a little bit. Why should there be different expectations of me than there are of the people who came before me? Now, I'm delighted that I can have the opportunity to do those things. And it was on my to-do list to get those double headers. Look, it's a no-brainer. And I'm still saying, I said it at GA Congress this year, I shouldn't have to do that because it should be happening at the top level when fixtures are being made at the national level of all three bodies. That is the time to coordinate them, you know, not to have all of the counties running around seeing what can we accommodate. They should come out to us in that way. And I really hope that will start to happen. I think, again, there's an awareness that it should. And from this year, from next year on, or from soon on, I suppose, it was passed at Congress this year, Camogie and Ladies Football will be represented on the GA Central Council, you know.
It's a big step.
It is a big step. So hopefully things like, just, I mean, it would be just so much easier for everyone if those fixtures were done at national level and just came out to us as a fait accompli.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have to worry about it.
I suppose, you know, 2018 was, it was a bit of a mad year more than anything else. And I always joke that Cork GA, that we definitely are the most radical GA groups in terms of, like, we are diehard extremists. But 2018, I remember hurling, it was a decent year, and I remember the defeat to Limerick. It was just, it was kind of sickening more so because you were like, oh man, we really had that in the bag. But I suppose football was extra tough. You know, Munster final, that, like, hammering to Kerry and Páirc Uí Chaoimh, you know, and the big hype of, oh, we're going to be playing in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, and then the subsequent defeat to Tyrone. I suppose you were looking at that, and was there a lot of people kind of coming to you going, this is, Tracy, what are you doing? This is your fault, you know, or did you find that, like, kind of tough? Not that you expected success, but were you kind of standing there going, oh, that's a bit of a shame?
Yeah, I think we were on a little bit of a high after our win over Tipperary.
Yeah.
Because that had been a really good game. I mean, we played really well. It was enjoyable football. And I suppose maybe we thought we were somewhere we weren't. But I always find Cork defeats hard. You know, why wouldn't I? You know, my whole, as I say, all every spare minute of my time is built around Cork. I am a fan above everything else.
Yeah.
I'm a fan, you know. I cry when we win, I cry when we lose. You know, it's part of the feelings that all our fans have. I feel the euphoria, I feel the devastation. So, and again, I have very high expectations for Cork. Like, I mean, I want to win the double every year.
Yeah.
And people say to me, oh, you're from a hurling area, but it's not like that for me. It's all Cork, you know, whether it's hurling, Camogie, ladies football or men's football, it's Cork. They're wearing a Cork jersey. I want them to win.
Yeah.
So the defeat to Kerry was very, very difficult. And then I suppose we still hoped we might pick it up. So the Tyrone one was the worst. That experience, I remember sitting up there and it's like, oh my God, it's just so awful.
I remember getting the call going, can you write 800 words on it? And I was like, oh, 800's a lot of words to put into this performance.
Oh, it was very, very hard. And it's so hard when on the players and management, because they, whatever I put in, like what they put in is unbelievable. I mean, their lives are on hold during the intercounty season. The commitment they make is absolutely phenomenal. And no team goes out to make that, to give that kind of performance. That's not how it works. And people seem to think that, you know, the lads lost on purpose or something like that. I find criticism of players like that difficult to take. But
I always find the lose on purpose and the whole team must be useless. I'm like, they're hardly selected now just because for a laugh. Like,
no,
you know.
And like the manager isn't going, well, there's 10 much better players, but I'm just not going to pick them. Like, you know, I mean, that's not how it works either. So that was a very hard defeat. And I felt that stage that I must try to do something. Like, Cork football hadn't been going well for a while.
Yeah.
And I was involved in the periphery, we'll say, in 2010. And that was so brilliant. You know, it was so fantastic. And at that time, we thought we could win another couple of All-Irelands, you know. So it was disappointing where football has gone since then. And, you know, I just did some talking to football people because, honestly, my background would be stronger in hurling. So I know more about hurling. I'd be more confident about hurling. So I spoke to a lot of football people, just to get ideas, see, you know, and the kind of view I was getting was that we needed some kind of a plan, that there's a lot wrong structurally in football in Cork. Now, I'd have some concerns about our structures in hurling as well, but we seem to make a better job of hurling at the moment. It's something we need to look at in the longer term, though, you know, what needs to improve there. But some of what we've put into our football plan will help hurling as well. That's the reality of it. So, yeah, I got permission from the county board to put together a group to develop a football plan, and I got my three first choices agreed to be part of it: Conor Coonan, Brian Cuthbert, and Graeme Canty.
Yep.
And you know, such brilliant people. Oh, sure, like, and I mean, totally in awe of them as well. Yep. You know, so it was brilliant that they agreed to be part of that. So we have our plan now, at least, but it's going to take some time. And you know, I think like after our first defeat in the league, we launched the plan maybe week before or 2 weeks before.
I was gonna say, yeah,
and people started the Cork 5 year plan, and I'm like, 5 year, not 5 minutes, yeah. You know, five year, please give us a chance. And like, there's nothing in that plan that's going to be achieved any sooner than within the first year.
Yeah.
So I would hope that people can give a chance, but I do understand, you know, Cork supporters, like you say, we do go to extremes. You know, when
we really do.
When Cork win, it's like, oh my God, the best thing in the world, and we're all absolutely high. And when Cork lose, it's total devastation. And I understand that because I'm part of it too. You know, I am that fan as well. But it does make it difficult at times. But I hope that people can bear with us. And we will need clubs to buy into this plan as well. That's the reality of it, you know.
During the week, I was reading Das Reboot. So it's the revival of the German Football Association, like way back in the day when they were kind of going downhill and they needed to come back. And I remember the media group who was funding the league. Obviously, this is professional, but it collapsed. So the league funding was gone. I remember then that resulted in the national team being like much worse than things like that. And I remember they all like came together, like sat down, and they had like some of the top old German players there, like Beckenbauer and all those, and they basically said, we have to focus on development. We obviously can't afford to bring in players anymore, which we can't do, obviously. We can't do in a GA circumstance, but you know. And that took, what, that plan was launched in 2001, and they didn't win the World Cup until 2014. You know, so you don't really, I think if you're working from developmental levels, you don't see it until 10 years later, which is like the frustrating thing, because I know you're like, oh, I'll be gone. But you're still like standing over it going, I want to see it now a little bit as well, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, like, success for me would be if I'm looking back in 6 or 7 years' time and Cork are successful, and I can say, well, you know, here's something that came out of my plan. But I also, like, I work in education, and like, you don't get short term results there either. Like, you know, I mean, it's often like you hear from someone who's grown up, like, and they say, God, you know, I never realised how much school did for me or whatever. So I'm used to having to wait for the results, but it's still frustrating. And, you know, I think every county chairperson would love Cork to win All-Ireland during their term, because it's absolutely brilliant. That's, you know, we're in it for the games. I mean, I like administration, but like, you know, I don't wake up in the morning going, yes, I have a meeting tonight. You know, it's not like that. It's all about the games and the teams. Where, you know, today is a great day for me, because even though it's busy, I'm going to matches, you know, so that's the best part of it.
It's fun for me.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, we, you know, reference the plan, we reference everything else. And I suppose having you in, we'd have to kind of mention a little bit that, you know, Páirc Uí Chaoimh and everything that's kind of happening with it. And I know Peter McKenna came out in the Examiner, and those figures were like vehemently denied by you and the board. And you've now said that it's, what, 95.8 million? Yeah, that's the, yeah. I'm getting nods. Yeah. But, you know, 14 million less, I think, than what actually Peter McKenna actually predicted. And then you opened Páirc Uí Chaoimh, and then the pitch happened. Like, that was, were you disappointed?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. I mean, 5 minutes into that match, I could see the sods coming up, and I was like, sick, you know?
Yeah.
This is absolutely appalling. It's really, really frustrating when something goes wrong on that scale.
I'm going to ask the really stupid question of, were you not told the pitch in advance was potentially going to be like this?
No, like, we knew the pitch was not perfect.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we had issues with it last year as well, but we weren't aware of the scale of that. Now, we did get a report on our desks on the Monday after that match, and if we had had that report on the Friday, there would have been no game played there, because it outlined exactly what happened. So we now do know what the problem is, and there are fundamental problems with the pitch. So a decision has been taken at this stage that it's going to be completely relaid after the Munster Championships. It should be fine for the Munster Championships. It was last year, even though the problems were the same.
Yeah.
But it just, there's better grass growth and so on as the year goes on, so it makes it playable.
Yeah.
And safe, which is the most important thing. But as soon as that Munster Championships are over, there's going to be a complete relaying of the pitch.
Okay.
And hopefully that should mean it'll be right for next year. But it's immensely frustrating, you know, and I find the whole stadium situation immensely frustrating.
Was the pitch, this is another stupid question, was the pitch relayed after it was built? or was it just
some of it? I know, again, I'm never 100% confident talking about these things because I wasn't involved in that project.
Yeah.
So I only know kind of things that I've heard.
And you know that I know nothing about pitches.
Exactly. And know what, I suppose people kind of wonder what went wrong with the pitch. Now, from what I can gather, total layperson view here in our life, but from what I'm picking up, there are a number of different things that led to the condition of the pitch being the way that it is. So like the people say, oh, it's under the water table and all that. That's not an issue at all.
Okay.
That's not, which is great. Like the primary drainage, which I've discovered is the lowest level of the drainage, we'll say is fine. There's no problem with anything like that. So the problems are further up, we'll say, in the structure of the pitch. So there's this thing called secondary drainage. Again, I'm no expert on these, but these are little drains that are all over the pitch. And some of those have kind of closed, they've got compressed and so on. So there needs to be work done on the drainage, and there needs to be probably, like, we're looking at probably a type of a hybrid grass.
Okay.
Again, these are all things I've learned about in the last few months. But it, rather than all natural grass, because the pitch doesn't get as much light as we'd like it to get, so we're looking at a kind of a combination of grasses. But it's really important to get it right.
You need to buy in those fancy lights.
The lighting rigs, they're things that are being looked at. They're very, very expensive, but these are all things that are being considered. But getting it right is the absolute main thing. And we have, like we'll say, I'm no expert, but we have people who are experts who are working on it.
And was it like incredibly disappointing that the GA came in, I'm not saying had to take over, but that looked like, I remember like working in the Irish Times, I went up to the office and the following day the joke was, can you not look after yourself down in Cork? Obviously that was annoying as well for you.
Well, it's not about the GA taking over, even though I know that's how it has been presented.
Yeah.
We're all part of the family.
Yeah.
And it's about the GA, Croke Park, we'll say, coming in and supporting us. And I'm delighted to have... What do I know about stadiums, Joanne? You know, I mean, I've never run one. And what do I know about building them? Absolutely nothing. I'm no expert.
Yeah.
I think if I was starting this project now, if it was starting in my term, I would have Croke Park involved from the very beginning because they have all the expertise. They have all the knowledge. So I'm really delighted, actually. And I'm not just saying that, like, that's not spin, you know.
Yeah.
It is so much comfort for me because I did not become chair of Cork County Board to run a stadium.
And also you weren't elected on your pitch knowledge either.
I wasn't elected on my pitch knowledge. Like, the stadium was something that I thought actually would be completely finished before I became chair. That was the original thing. Like, I thought, in fact, I used to joke about it, you know, oh, you built it, now I'll have to take it from there. But like, it was my understanding that, and that was what the intention was, that everything to do with the stadium would be complete, in place, its board would be up and running, and that my only role would be as a member of that board, we'd say. I thought that's how it would be. I think if I knew what I know now, I would have had second thoughts, to be honest, because I don't have knowledge and expertise in that area. And that is why I am really glad that we have the likes of Peter McKenna, even though he might have put, you know, unfortunate things out in the media, he still is a very experienced person in terms of running a stadium.
Yeah.
We also have a couple of very good representatives of the Croke Park Stadium Board who are part of it. These are experienced people, John Murphy from Sligo and Tom Gray from Dublin, and great GAA people as well. I think Tom is involved with the Dublin Under 20 footballers. So, like, they're people who have a great understanding, they have great knowledge, and, like, what we need is to get that stadium to a situation where it runs as a successful business and as a successful stadium, pays for itself, and hopefully in time generates income for Cork County Board, as Croke Park does now for the GAA, but didn't always either.
Yeah.
You know, so that's where we want to get to. It's going to take a bit longer than I might have thought originally, but it will get to that point, you know. And when people come down and look at it, like, they're so always impressed. It's a brilliant, wonderful stadium. And when you look at what it can do for Cork, I mean, the Ed Sheeran concerts last year were so brilliant for Cork.
Yeah.
We're going to have a great day. I didn't realise Rod Stewart was on the Late Late Show recently, but apparently he was on, you know, and that's going to be a great occasion for Cork. And hopefully we'll have a lot more of those occasions over the years, you know. And even Munster finals, these are brilliant for the local economy as well as for the GAA.
Yeah.
So I think we have a brilliant asset. Yes, it's very frustrating for me that there are still problems with it. I would like it to be right. Obviously, everyone in Cork wants it to be right. I can understand how disappointing it is for our fans, how people feel embarrassed. Do you know? I feel all those things too.
Yeah.
So we have to get it right.
Do you think as well that people are extra annoyed because they see the GAA kind of increasing prices and tickets, and then they see the GAA bailing out Cork, and they see GAA bailing out Galway, and like, there are people in Kerry telling me, I don't want to bail you out, you know. Do you think that frustration is there as well?
Yeah, I think the whole bailing out thing is, I suppose, unfortunate terminology as well.
It sounds dramatic, yeah.
It does. And like, it's probably like, I mean, it's probably something that's only really come into our lexicon in the last few years as a result of economic issues in the country, which are a lot more serious than that. But again, like going back to the thing, we're all part of the same family.
Okay.
So the GAA gives grants to all counties for infrastructure projects, you know, so we're all part of the same family and we're very glad to have the support. Like, it's like any, if you have any family difficulty, you're glad to have the support of the rest of your family. And I think that's what it's like for us. So we need support. Galway needs support at present. You know, in 5 years' time, someone else will need support. You look at the problems with Casement Park at the moment, which isn't even built, you know. Yeah. And that must be horrendously frustrating for the people involved up there. At least we have our stadium, you know, along with its associated problems, maybe, but we have it.
You can see why then, I suppose, people then get extra annoyed, you know, because they feel like, and not just you particular, but they feel like other people aren't coming out and being 100% clear. You know, like, you know, we have like the 95.8 million figure, but people are still coming up to me going, yeah, but ask her if the pitch is involved or ask her if this is involved, you know, and things like that. And I think people just, I think the thing with Ireland is that we rely so heavily on volunteers. Sometimes like we forget, like you were saying, it's all one big family.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we forget, like, I'm not saying sometimes it looks so bad, but sometimes it can be so bad. You don't want to inform them because you're so like, oh, like, I can't believe it got to the stage, you know.
Yeah,
what I
it's
mean?
Never like that, though. I mean, the only thing that ever stops me from saying anything for definite is if it's not definite.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing worse than saying, you know, something is going to cost X amount or something is going to happen and it doesn't, you know. So a lot of the problem that I have, are, and people, it's hard to explain this to people. I know I would find it hard to understand if I wasn't on the inside myself with it. So I totally understand that people find it hard to understand, but there still are a number of variables associated with the stadium. So the 95, some of those are commercially sensitive. So like, I would love to be able to come out and explain them, but I can't because there's commercial sensitivity there. And doing so could damage Cartier, and you know, because it might say cause something to cost more. Like, if I come out and say, I think the pitch is going to cost X amount to replace, then all the contractors out there who might be doing the job are saying, well, this is what they're prepared to spend on it.
Yeah.
So this is what we'll charge them.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that might, it might end up then costing more than it should. So I have to be aware of all of that as well, in terms of, and not just me, like the people involved in the stadium board. And I'm only one member of that board. We have to be careful what we say, because anything we say is taken to be certain. And there are variables, but that we're told by the people involved, so Michael O'Flynn and Tom Gray, who examined all of the figures in detail, they tell us that 95.8 million is their best estimate, taking into account those variables, and they have taken views on those variables, and they have included a figure for the cost of the pitch. So taking all those things into account, these are very experienced people.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, so experienced in this area, and that is their best estimate. So I can't do better than that myself. I have no knowledge in that area.
Yeah.
But that's what they're telling us, that their best estimate of the figure will be. I understand that that's not good enough for some people. But, you know, it's very difficult to be that certain about anything. You know?
I'm going to have a Theresa May moment here. Jesus. Looking forward, then, I suppose, this isn't going to work. Looking forward, I suppose, your future. What's in your future?
I suppose if I've learned anything from having cancer, is that you can actually never be certain what the future holds, do you know? And I'm just one of those people who doesn't like too much forward planning. But my term as chairperson ends in at the end of next year. So I'm nearly halfway through my term. And I think at that stage, I'd be quite happy to go back and spend some time with my club, you know, because I don't get to spend a lot of time involved with my club anymore. And like, that's my first love. Obviously, the club is what it's all about. You even ask any intercounty player about their highlights, and winning something with their club will nearly be it. So I'm looking forward to going back, spending a bit of time in my club. There's a few other things I kind of want to do in my life as well. And obviously, it'd be nice to have a bit more time to focus on work and my family and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, I don't have any massive plans beyond the end of next year. We'll see where things go with it. At this point in time, I sometimes wonder, will I get as far as the middle of this year, never mind the end of next year? You know, I've been tempted a few times. I'm laughing about it now, but I've asked myself a few times, would I be better off just stepping away from all of this, you know? So I'm looking forward to having a little break when I get to the end of my term.
Theresa, it's been great to have you. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks a million, Joanne.
Thank you very much. So that was the end of our interview with Tracy Kennedy. Thanks obviously to Tracy for giving up her incredible, valuable time. We know she's incredibly busy with all the hard work that she's doing at the moment. Next week, we have Mary O'Connor, ex-Cork Camogie and ladies footballer, holder of 21 All-Ireland medals and current CEO Federation of Irish Sport. Don't forget to follow us at Big Red Bench and at Joanne OR_OX. See you soon.
Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.